content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. And this week, we'll be reading from the edition dated April 29th, 2011. And our first story from the main story section of The Week magazine this week is entitled The Stakes Rise on Resolving the Budget. What happened? The sharp partisan divide over how to reduce the nation's deficit widened this past week as Republicans and Democrats dug in to defend their respective proposals to shrink the 2012 budget. In a series of campaign-style speeches, President Obama argued that a combination of spending cuts and tax hikes was the only way to lower the deficit. House Republicans, meanwhile, voted in favor of Representative Paul Ryan's proposal to more severely slash spending, cut taxes, and privatize Medicare. That budget plan passed on a 235 to 193 vote in the House, but is expected to be defeated in the Senate. Ryan branded Obama's proposal hopelessly inadequate, while the president was caught on an open microphone mocking Ryan for styling himself America's accountant. As Washington traded barbs, Wall Street raised the stakes with warnings that the continuing failure to resolve the fiscal crisis endangers the nation's financial credibility. Rating agency Standard & Poor's lowered its outlook on the U.S. credit rating, while economists and Wall Street CEOs expressed fear that Congress would push the government into default if it fails to raise the $14.3 trillion debt ceiling next month. House Republicans have threatened to oppose the increase until Democrats agree to slash spending, while Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner took pains to assure the market, saying Congress is going to have to raise the debt limit. They understand that. Now here's what the editorials had to say. Standard & Poor's threat to devalue the nation's debt is a disturbingly big deal, said the Chicago Tribune. If our credit rating were actually downgraded, a Greece-style debt crisis could unfold in the U.S. with dire consequences for the global economy. Even the world's most powerful nation can't buy time forever when it's running up a tab it hasn't got the money to pay. That's true, but we didn't need S&P to say so, said Investors Business Daily. After all, it is one of the oracles of dependable wisdom that gave mortgage-backed securities the full seal of approval until the very day the housing bubble burst. S&P is simply repeating what the rest of us have known forever. Catastrophe is just around the bend if President Obama's spending mania isn't stopped. Unfortunately, lawmakers of both stripes would rather play politics than make tough choices, said the Orlando Sentinel. The Ryan and Obama plans have enough in common for a possible compromise between the parties. But the Republicans have ruled out tax hikes, while Democrats refuse to consider restructuring Medicare and Medicaid. As long as both sides refuse to leave their partisan bunkers, there's no hope for the deal we need. What the columnist said, there is one hope amid all this political intransigence, said Clifford Marks in NationalJournal.com. A bipartisan group of senators known as the Gang of Six, led by Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin and Oklahoma Republican Tom Coburn, has been working on a plan to bridge the gap between the two parties. S&P's action should only strengthen the Gang of Six's hand as the group struggles for consensus. I'm not so sure consensus is a good thing, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Whenever Washington comes up with a supposedly bipartisan fix, it ends up having been conceived on Republican turf, as it is with the Gang of Six. So let's not be civil. Let Republicans and Democrats have a frank discussion of whose plan is best. American voters deserve no less. These squabbles will pale in comparison with the partisan posturing ahead on the unpopular debt ceiling vote, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post. That's when normal congressional bickering could prove especially dangerous by pushing the government to the edge of the abyss of default and turning world markets against the U.S. And a market revolt is now a real threat, said Michael Schumann in Time. The U.S. is one of the only debt-laden world economies with no credible plan to control deficits and debt. Yet policymakers naively continue to act as if the country is simply too exceptional to face economic ruin. We may soon find that even the U.S. is not too big to fail. Also from the main news stories this week, the next one entitled Wake Up Call for the FAA. Public outrage forced the Federal Aviation Administration to issue new rules after seven air traffic controllers at airports around the country were found sleeping on the job. I don't know when I've ever been madder, said Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, who reported that all seven had been suspended and may ultimately be fired. The epidemic started in March when a controller at Reagan National Airport near Washington, D.C. nodded off while two jumbo jets landed without clearance. Since then, reports have emerged of six more sleeping controllers, another caught watching a DVD on the job, and one whose misjudgment forced the plane carrying First Lady Michelle Obama to abort a landing because it was too close to a military cargo plane. The official in charge of air traffic control was forced out, and a new set of regulations rushed into effect to calm the public. Doubled coverage in 27 towers and decreed that all controllers must now take at least 9 hours, up from 8 hours, between shifts. Sounds good, means little, said the New York Daily News in an editorial. The problem will not be solved by mandating an extra hour of downtime. It goes deeper than that. Controllers' work schedules are designed for long weekends, not public safety. Many work 5 8-hour shifts in 4 days, rotating through midnight, morning, and swing shifts, with 16 hours of work on the last day. This union-negotiated practice is reckless and disruptive, said the Denver Post. In Canada, Japan, Germany, and elsewhere, napping is encouraged on overnight shifts, an idea that LaHood emphatically rejected. Let them nap, said Matthew Edlund, M.D., in HuffingtonPost.com. It'll happen anyway. Controllers work in the dark, surrounded by flickering lights, often in the wee hours, when not much happens. Rotating shifts produce a kind of perpetual jet lag. But enforcing nap times and rejiggering schedules are just short-term band-aid fixes anyway, said Investors Business Daily. The real problems are controller errors, which increased by 81% from 2007 to 2010. Technology that's less sophisticated than a $200 GPS, and bureaucratic inertia, which has stifled change. In 50 other countries, air traffic control has been turned over to nonprofits, saving money while improving safety. It's time the U.S. woke up and got with the program. And the next big item under the main stories in the Week magazine this week is entitled Under Siege in Libya. Civilian casualties continue to mount in the besieged Libyan city of Misrata this week, almost 2 months after forces loyal to dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi began pounding the port with rockets, cluster bombs, and sniper fire. At least 300 deaths have been recorded in Misrata, the last opposition-held city in western Libya, but rebels said the real death toll is closer to 1,000. NATO jets patrolling the skies above Misrata have so far proved powerless to stop the slaughter, as the regime has stationed its heavy artillery in densely populated neighborhoods, which the alliance won't bomb for fear of killing civilians. Misrata is finished, said one local. Someone needs to save us. NATO has so far refused to deploy ground troops, but Britain, France, and Italy have agreed to send several dozen military advisers to the eastern opposition stronghold of Benghazi to help organize the ramshackle rebel army. President Obama's poor military choices are prolonging Misrata's misery, said the Washington Post in an editorial. The only planes that can root out the artillery Qaddafi has positioned in built-up areas without causing massive civilian casualties are American ground attack aircraft like the A-10 Warthog. But Obama has refused to supply NATO with these planes in order to make the ideological point that the U.S. is not playing the lead role in this operation. The fact that Britain and France, the countries doing most of the bombing, need U.S. help to take on Qaddafi's pitiful forces should be a wake-up call, said James Joyner in Foreign Policy. For too long, European nations have cut military spending and allowed America to shoulder the burden. This latest operation might serve to remind our NATO allies that there is value in investing in their own defense. Whoever's at fault, the ongoing deadlock in Libya is a real threat to U.S. power, said Leslie Gelb in the DailyBeast.com. Iran and North Korea are feeling increasingly confident as the mighty NATO and the U.S. can't humble that weirdo Colonel Qaddafi and his pint-sized army. And the longer this conflict goes on, the more Tehran and Pyongyang will come to believe that the West can't do decisive harm to them. Our next item is from the section entitled Controversy of the Week. Donald Trump, is he really serious about running? If this is all a big joke, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, I'm having trouble laughing. Until this week, it was widely assumed that Donald Trump's public flirtation with running for president was just the latest over-the-top publicity stunt from a man who has made an art of grabbing headlines over four decades in the public eye. But the waxen-haired real estate tycoon continues to insist that he's serious, and now a stunning new poll shows Trump actually leading the field of GOP candidates for the 2012 nomination. Behind the scenes, some Republican insiders are genuinely starting to embrace Trump's presidential bid, said Charles Babington in the Associated Press. Some of his positions may be controversial, from his championing of the birther theory that President Obama was born overseas to his declaration this week that we should invade Middle Eastern countries and, as Trump says, take the oil. But with the GOP hungry for a forceful, colorful figure to take on Obama in the general election, a Trump candidacy is looking more viable than every day. Dream on, said Richard Cohen in the Washington Post. Such a man cannot become president. For Trump to win, even the GOP nomination would require conservative voters to overlook his three marriages, his dubious claims to religious faith and pro-life credentials, and his previous enthusiasm for both Barack Obama and universal health care. The Republican establishment will never let it get that far, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. Party leaders know the GOP would have a real crisis on its hands if Trump actually won the nomination. His antics would stain the GOP's reputation indelibly, and he'd doom the party to near certain defeat, even if he were to run as a third-party candidate. In other words, the more serious and viable Trump's candidacy starts to look, the more viciously GOP leaders and the conservative media will work to destroy it. Trump is no joke, said David Brooks in the New York Times. I'm not saying that he could be president or even that he could get close. His declaration last week that he has always had a great relationship with the blacks, for instance, probably indicates a fatal case of political tone deafness. But those who dismiss Trump as a clown are missing something profound about the American psyche. Trump is one of those few rare souls who rise above subservience, insecurity, and concern. His belief in himself and his own rightness is absolute and unlimited, and as much as we love to roll our eyes at his vulgarity, his hair, and his relentless self-promotion, we cannot help but also see Trump as the living, walking personification of the gospel of success. In bleak, uncertain times like these, such a figure can hold considerable appeal. Trump is not the American dream, said Cale Milner in the San Francisco Chronicle. If anything, he's a nightmarish parody of self-actualization who will say and do whatever it takes to advance his own interests. The good news, I suspect, is that the man has no intention of ever standing before the voters, exposing his private life and his finances to the withering scrutiny of political opponents. The bad news is that we have allowed our political system to be overrun by these colorful, larger-than-life personalities who sow division and make outrageous claims just to further their own careers. It may be entertaining to watch sometimes, but this is not a reality show. This is our country. And now it's time for us to turn to the lighter side of the news as we look at the Week magazine and the popular column, Good Week for and Bad Week for. It was a good week for retired General Stanley McChrystal after the Pentagon released a report concluding that not all the events occurred as reported in the June 2010 Rolling Stone article that suggested McChrystal lacked respect for civilian authority. The article led to his forced resignation. It was a good week for swearing after researchers at Keele University in the UK found that yelling obscenities helps increase tolerance of pain for both men and women. And it was a good week for penny pinching after residents of Picayune, Mississippi collected over 10 million pennies to raise funds to refurbish a local park, which will now get a treehouse and other features. It was a bad week for Czech President Václav Klaus after he was caught pocketing a pen during the news conference with Chilean President Sebastián Piñera. Czech media are calling Klaus a thief, but his office claims that he had a right to take the ceremonial pen. It was a bad week for time travel after China's State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television said it was considering banning the narrative devices used in TV shows. The producers and writers are treating serious history in a frivolous way, which should be by no means be encouraged any longer, said agency official Li Zhenyang. And it was a bad week for lonely fugitives after Manuel Albert Suarez, an international fugitive sought by Portugal since he skipped out on a prison sentence in 2008, was caught driving in the carpool lane of the New Jersey Turnpike without enough passengers. And you're listening to The Week magazine for April 29th, 2011. Thanks for listening today. Let's turn now to our section entitled People. The first item is Quaid's rueful memories of a blown past. Dennis Quaid regrets all those years he spent doing cocaine, he tells Newsweek. The actor, who is 57 years old, first tried the drug when he went to Hollywood in 1974. It was very casual at first, he says. That's what people were doing when they were at parties. Cocaine was even in the budgets of movies, thinly disguised. Coming from a lower middle class upbringing in Houston, he started using the drug to help him cope with celebrity. By the late 1980s, around the time he was shooting the film The Big Easy, his addiction was full blown. I was a mess. I'd wake up, snort a line, and swear I wasn't going to do it again that day. But then 4 o'clock rolled around, and I'd be right back down the same road like a little squirrel on one of those treadmills. One night in the 1990s, he says, I had one of those white light experiences where I realized I was going to be dead in 5 years if I didn't change my ways. The next day, he was in rehab, which thankfully cured him. Those years recovering actually chiseled me into a person. If I hadn't gone through that period, I don't know if I'd still be acting. The next item is the geologist who predicted Japan's earthquake. Masanobu Shishikura saw the earthquake coming, said Peter Landers in the Wall Street Journal. The Japanese geologist, 41, would have preferred to be wrong, but on March 11th, when the bookshelves and televisions in his office came crashing down around him, he tragically wasn't. It was the phenomenon just as I envisioned it, he says, of the 9.0 quake and the tsunami that devastated Japan's northeastern coast. Shishikura's studies in the emerging field of paleoseismology had convinced him that every 450 to 800 years, colliding plates produced tsunami waves around Japan's Miyagi and Fukushima prefectures, and that the possibility of such a disaster happening in the near future was very high. He even had an appointment scheduled for March 23rd to explain his research to officials in Fukushima. It's unfortunate that there wasn't time, he says. Had he given his warning, Shishikura believes many of the tsunami's victims might have been saved. It appears to be almost completely unknown among the general public that in the past great tsunamis have inundated areas as far as 3 to 4 kilometers inland as a result of earthquakes exceeding magnitude 8, he wrote last year. Shishikura now believes it's never too early to sound the alarm. We had better be on the lookout, he says. And our next item from People, Woods' return from rebellion. Evan Rachel Wood's adolescent rebellion was epic, said Tom Schoen in New York. I didn't really get a normal childhood, says the actress, who is 23. She was just 9 when her mother, a former actress, divorced her husband, moved them to Los Angeles, and became Wood's full-time drama coach. We shared a room, we shared a bed, says Wood. We hadn't been apart for more than a week my whole life. When Wood took a role in the film 13 as a teenage girl who battles with her mother, art soon imitated life. The minute I turned 18, I hopped on Marilyn Manson's tour bus and was like, I'm going to have an adolescence. Wood was 18, Manson 39, when they began a wild relationship which ended last August. Manson gave me what I felt I'd missed out on, where you get to experiment and cut loose and change and grow. I lived 50 lifetimes in those 4 years. Now she's reconciled with her mother, and her musical tastes have shifted radically. People honestly think I'm kidding about Justin Bieber, she says. My mom is so confused. She's like, Evan, really? I'm like, go see Never Say Never. You'll understand. And now let's turn to the section from the Week magazine called The Briefing. And the headline for this week is Britain's First Family. The world seems enthralled by the royal wedding. But what's the real state of the British monarchy? Do the British still believe in the crown? It's complicated. Polls consistently show that around 70% of Britons support the monarchy. And if you tune in to Prince William and Kate Middleton's wedding on April 29th, when at least 500,000 people are expected to crowd into central London to cheer on the happy couple, you'll likely come away thinking Britain is a nation of ardent royalists. But much of the population is apathetic about this ancient institution. Almost 3/4 of British citizens believe the country would be worse off without a royal family. But in a recent survey, 4 out of 5 respondents declared they were either largely indifferent or couldn't care less about the upcoming nuptials. The British public are simply not excited about the royals anymore, said Graham Smith of the anti-royal group Republic, which wants the monarch replaced with an elected head of state. How does the wedding affect the royals' popularity? Smith said that his organization's membership has grown by 50% since William and Kate announced their engagement in November. That spike in anti-royalist sentiment is partly due to negative headlines noting that the government is spending up to $33 million on security for the wedding at a time of massive public sector spending cuts. But Brits won't be booting Queen Elizabeth II and family out of Buckingham Palace anytime soon. Republic still has only 10,000 paying members, less than 0.02% of the population. And royal wedding fever seems to have drained the radicalism from some Republicans. Today, only 13% of people want the monarchy scrapped, down from 19% 6 years ago. Does it cost too much to keep a royal family? The Crown receives $62 million a year from the government, about a dollar for every citizen, to pay for palaces, staff, and travel. However, critics argue the true cost is closer to $300 million a year if you include the royal security costs and deferred taxes. But even if this last figure is correct, royalists say the monarchy is good value for the money, as foreign tourists spend $820 million a year visiting royal castles and attractions. The German presidency costs about the same as the Queen, wrote conservative commentator Gerald Warner in the London Telegraph. But how many tourists line the streets of Berlin to catch a glimpse of, what's her name? How have the royals lasted so long? By moving with the times, the British monarchy, usually dated from William the Conqueror, who led the Norman invasion of 1066, is an eminently adaptable institution that evolves with its subjects, said British historian Tristram Hunt. In the 19th century, Queen Victoria served as a ceremonial figurehead who united the culturally diverse British Empire. George V, Elizabeth II's grandfather, reinvented the dynasty after the chaos of World War I as a stabilizing family monarchy built on sturdy middle-class values. And following the death of Princess Diana in 1997, the Windsors have tried to shake off their cold, stuffy image by becoming a welfare monarchy dedicated to charitable work. Will and Kate's marriage is the latest phase in this modernization process. Prince William might have chosen his commoner wife-to-be for romantic reasons, said historian Dominic Sandbrook, but he has also picked a perfect candidate to show that the royal family is ready to embrace a more democratic century. Is everyone happy with William's choice? Some class-conscious snobs are not amused that the 28-year-old prince has settled for a commoner descended from coal miners and laborers over a bride with hereditary title. Charles Moseley, editor-in-chief of Burke's Peerage, Barontage, and Knightage, the who's who of British blue bloods, said that even after eliminating the married women and those too old, 10,000 noble women would be eligible. A few of William's well-heeled friends have reportedly mocked Middleton's humble family background, dismissing her mother, a former flight attendant, with the phrase, "doors to manual." Many ordinary Brits are derisive of such comments because while Middleton, 29, might technically be a commoner, she's anything but common. Her parents are millionaires thanks to their party-planning business, and Middleton was educated at Marlborough College, a top boarding school that charges $50,000 a year in fees. What is the monarchy's future? The Windsors could be in for a tough decade. Australia's Prime Minister Julia Gillard has said that she wants her country, one of 15 former British colonies where the monarch is still head of state, to become a republic when the 85-year-old queen dies or abdicates. Her death could also spell trouble in the UK, as Elizabeth II is the glue that holds the monarchy together, said Roy Greenslade, a columnist for the London Guardian. He notes that heir apparent Prince Charles doesn't command the respect his mother does because of his failed marriage to Princess Diana and his eccentric campaigns against modern architecture and for alternative medicines. The public also has doubts about other clan members, such as scandal-prone Prince Andrew. You have a dysfunctional family, said Greenslade, so it really falls on William and Kate to actually be an upright couple that can engage with the public and be glamorous at the same time. And now from the Week magazine for this week, let's take a look at the columns that are selected this week as the best columns in the United States. The first one is entitled, "The President Has Lost His Mojo," and it's written by David Shribman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. "Whatever happened to Barack Obama's instinct for audacity?" asked David Shribman. "The boldness that propelled an untested junior senator to the highest office in the land has evaporated. Obama seems downright paralyzed by caution. He has been caught flat-footed by the pace of change in the Middle East and put on the defensive by the suddenly powerful House Speaker John Boehner, who's come out on top every time the two have tangled." The president's budget speech last week was clearly an effort to regain the offensive, but he's fighting on Republican turf, even though Democrats control two-thirds of Washington's policy-making machinery. On the signature issues of the day, the deficit and the budget, the president has been absent or late, and he's left the heavy lifting to his political opponents. Lately, Obama's been quoting Ronald Reagan, who often said he didn't care who got the credit as long as things got done. That may be a practical strategy in a time of divided government, but it only reinforces the impression that the Republicans are the party in power in Washington. The next column this week, The Secret War on Birth Control, written by Gail Collins in the New York Times. Senator John Kill's wildly inaccurate attack on Planned Parenthood is one for the record books, said Gail Collins. He recently declared that abortions constituted well over 90% of what the organization does, when the true figure is just 3%. His staff later explained to widespread derision that that was not intended to be a factual statement. But there was a hidden reason behind his deliberate obfuscation of Planned Parenthood's focus on family planning. It's that a large part of the anti-abortion community is also anti-contraception. They just don't say outright, since studies show that even faithful Catholics and evangelicals rely on the pill to avoid pregnancy. By portraying the fight against Planned Parenthood as merely an anti-abortion crusade, social conservatives are concealing a wide-ranging attack on women's right to control their productive lives. Women would surely object if they knew the conservatives' true intent. No wonder anti-abortion activists and the senators who support them prefer to lay off the factual statements. And the third column this week in the Week magazine, judged as the best in the U.S., Remembering the Real Ayn Rand. Donald Ruskin, The Wall Street Journal, is the writer. Novelist Ayn Rand's new role as the Tea Party Nostradamus is hardly a perfect fit, said Donald Ruskin. Many on the right claim that her 1957 ode to unfettered capitalism, Atlas Shrugged, a movie version of which opened last week, accurately predicted America's recent economic collapse amid massive government expansion. Republican Representative Paul Ryan even demands that all of his staffers read the tome and absorb its free market message. But the real Rand never meshed easily with the conservative movement, which loathed her during her lifetime. Rand, who died in 1982, was an atheist, a feminist, an outspoken supporter of abortion rights, and an opponent of the Vietnam War. Her private life was also anything but conservative. She once launched into an affair after having duly informed her husband and the younger man's wife in advance. And while Republicans like Rand laud Atlas Shrugged as a capitalist Bible, the novel warns that crony capitalism can threaten the full unfolding of the economy just as badly as government regulation can. So instead of calling her a conservative, we should remember Rand for what she really was, an individualist who believed in that most fundamental American ideal, the inalienable rights of the individual. And you're listening to our reading of the Week magazine for April 29th, 2011. And now we turn to the very popular column in the Week magazine entitled The Last Word. This particular edition is entitled Anatomy of a Tragic Error: How a Cascade of False Assumptions Led to a Fatal U.S. Military Strike on a Group of Afghan Civilians. Nearly 3 miles above the rugged hills of central Afghanistan, American eyes silently tracked two SUVs and a pickup truck as they snarked down a dirt road in the pre-dawn darkness. The vehicles, packed with people, were 3.5 miles from a dozen U.S. Special Operations soldiers who had been dropped into the area hours earlier to root out insurgents. The convoy was closing in on them. At 6:15 a.m., just before the sun crested the mountains, the convoy halted. "We have 18 passengers dismounted and spreading out at this time," an Air Force pilot said from a cramped control room at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. Sitting 7,000 miles away from Afghanistan, the pilot was flying the Predator drone, whose cameras had picked up the vehicle's movement more than an hour earlier. He was using a joystick to operate the craft while watching its live video transmissions and radioing information to the unit on the ground. The Afghans unfolded what looked like blankets and kneeled. "They're praying," said the Predator's camera operator, seated in Nevada near the pilot. By now, the Predator crew was sure that the men were Taliban. "This is definitely it. This is their force," the cameraman said. "They're going to do something nefarious," chimed in a third man in Nevada, the mission's intelligence coordinator. At 6:22 a.m., the drone pilot radioed an update. "All are rallying up near all three vehicles." The camera operator watched the men climb back into the vehicles. "Oh, sweet target," he said. None of those Afghans was, in fact, an insurgent. They were men, women, and children going about their business, unaware that a unit of U.S. soldiers was just a few miles away and that teams of U.S. military pilots and video analysts had taken them for a group of Taliban fighters. Though the Americans were using some of the most sophisticated tools in the history of war, the high-tech wizardry would fail in its most elemental purpose, to tell the difference between friend and foe. The Afghan travelers had set out early on that cold morning of February 21, 2010, from three mountain villages in southern Dainkundi province, a remote region 200 miles southwest of Kabul. More than two dozen people were wedged into the three vehicles. They included shopkeepers going to Kabul for supplies, students returning to school, people seeking medical treatment, and families off to visit relatives. There were several women and as many as four children younger than six. They had agreed to meet before dawn for the long drive to Highway 1, the country's main paved road. To reach it, they had to drive through Orozgan province, an insurgent stronghold. "We weren't worried when we set out," said Nasim, an auto mechanic who says he was traveling to buy tools and parts. "We were a little scared of the Taliban, but not of government forces," he said, referring to the Afghan National Army and its U.S. allies. "Why would they attack us?" American aircraft began tracking the vehicles at 5 a.m. The crew of an AC-130, a U.S. ground attack plane, spotted a pickup and an SUV converge from different directions. At 5:08 a.m., they saw two of the drivers flash their headlights in the darkness. With that, the travelers became targets of suspicion. A few hours earlier, a dozen U.S. Special Operations soldiers, known as an A-Team, had been dropped off by helicopter near Khod, 5 miles south of the convoy. The elite unit was moving on foot toward the village to search for insurgents. Another U.S. Special Operations unit had been attacked in the district a year earlier, and a soldier had been killed. This time, the AC-130, the Predator drone, and two Kiowa attack helicopters were in the area to protect the A-Team. Under U.S. military rules, the Army captain leading the A-Team as the operations ground force commander was responsible for deciding whether to order an airstrike. At 5:14 a.m., 6 minutes after the two Afghan vehicles flashed their lights, the AC-130 crew asked the A-Team what it wanted to do about the suspicious vehicles. "Roger, Ground Force Commander's intent is to destroy the vehicles and the personnel," came the unit's reply. To actually employ deadly force, the commander would also have to make a positive identification that the adversary was carrying weapons and posed an imminent threat. The evidence to support such a decision would come from two distant sources. In addition to the Predator crew in Nevada, a team of screeners, enlisted personnel trained in video analysis, was on duty at Air Force Special Operations Headquarters in Okaloosa, Florida. They sat in a large room with high-definition televisions showing live feeds from the drone. "We all had in our head, hey, why do you have 20 military-age males at 5 a.m. collecting each other?" an Army officer involved in the incident said later. "There can be only one reason, and that's because we've put U.S. troops in the area." At 5:15 a.m., the Predator pilot thought he saw a rifle inside one of the two vehicles he'd first spotted. "See if you can zoom in on that guy," he told the camera operator. "Maybe just a warm spot," the operator replied, referring to an image picked up by the infrared camera. "Can't really tell right now." At 5:30 a.m., not long after the first two vehicles were joined by another SUV, the convoy halted briefly, and the drone's camera focused on a man emerging from one of the vehicles. He appeared to be carrying something. I think that dude had a rifle, the camera operator said. I do too, the pilot replied. But the ground forces unit said the commander needed more information from the drone crew and screeners to establish a positive identification. The small convoy continued south in the general direction of Cod. At 5:37 a.m., the pilot reported that one of the screeners in Florida had spotted one or more children in the group. Bull! Where? The camera operator said. I don't think they have kids out at this hour. He demanded that the screeners freeze a video image of the purported child and email it to him. Why didn't he say possible child, the pilot said. Why are they so quick to call kids, but not to call a rifle? The cameraman was dubious, too. I really doubt that children call, he said. A few minutes later, the pilot who was tasked with radioing the screener's observations to the ground unit appeared to downplay the screener's report, alerting the A-team to a possible rifle and two possible children near the SUV. The Predator video was not the only intelligence that morning suggesting that U.S. forces were in danger. Teams of U.S. intelligence personnel with sophisticated eavesdropping equipment were vacuuming up cell phone calls in the area. For several hours, they had been listening to chatter in the area that suggested a Taliban unit was assembling for an attack. The drone crew took the intercepted conversations as confirmation that there were insurgents in the convoy. The screeners continued to look for evidence that the convoy was a hostile force. Even with the advanced cameras on the Predator, the images were fuzzy. The Predator crew and video analysts remained uncertain how many children were in the group and how old they were. Our screeners are currently calling 21 MAMs, that's military-age males, no females, and two possible children. How copy? The Predator pilot radioed the A-team at 7:38 a.m. Roger, replied the A-team, which was unable to see the convoy. And when we say children, we are talking teenagers or toddlers? The camera operator responded, not toddlers, something more toward adolescents or teens. At 7:40 a.m., the A-team radioed that its captain had concluded that he had established positive identification based on the weapons we've identified and the demographics of the individuals, plus the intercepted communications. Although no weapons had been clearly identified, the pilot replied, "We are with you." The pilot added that one screener had amended his report and was now saying he'd seen only one teenager. We'll pass that along to the ground force commander, the A-team radio operator said. 12 or 13 years old with a weapon is just as dangerous. At 8:43 a.m., Army commanders ordered two Kiowa helicopters to get into position to attack. By then, though, the convoy was no longer heading toward Cod. The three vehicles had changed direction and were now 12 miles from the Special Operations soldiers. The drone crew didn't dwell on that news, thinking the convoy probably was trying to flank the A-team's position. The Predator crew began discussing the coming attack. The drone's one missile was not enough to take out a three-vehicle convoy. The more heavily armed Kiowa helicopters would fire on the vehicles. The Predator would target any survivors who tried to flee. A little before 9 a.m., the vehicles reached an open, treeless stretch of road. The A-team commander called in the airstrike. "Understand, we are clear to engage," one of the helicopter pilots radioed. Hellfire missiles struck the first and third vehicles. They burst into flames. On the ground, the damage was horrific. Nassim, the 23-year-old mechanic, was fortunate that he was merely knocked unconscious. Many fellow travelers were dead. "When I came to, I could see that our vehicles were wrecked and the injured were everywhere," he said. "I saw someone who was headless and someone else cut in half." The Predator crew in Nevada was exultant, watching men they assumed were enemy fighters trying to help the injured. "Self-aid, buddy care to the rescue," one crew member said. "I forget, how do you treat a sucking chest wound?" said another. Soon, however, the crew in Nevada and the screeners in Florida realized something was wrong. At 9:15 a.m., the Predator crew noticed three survivors in brightly colored clothing waving at the helicopters. They were trying to surrender. "What are those?" asked the camera operator. "Women and children," the Predator's mission intelligence coordinator answered. "Younger than an adolescent to me," the camera operator said. U.S. and Afghan forces reached the scene 2.5 hours after the attack to provide medical assistance. Medevac helicopters began taking the wounded to a hospital in Tarin Kaut in Oruzgan. By the U.S. count, 15 or 16 men were killed and 12 were wounded, including a woman and 3 children. Elders from the Afghans' home villages said in interviews that 23 had been killed, including 2 boys, Daoud, 3, and Murtaza, 4. That evening, Army General Stanley A. McChrystal, then the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, went to the presidential palace in Kabul to apologize to President Hamid Karzai. 2 days later, he went on Afghan television and promised a thorough investigation to prevent this from happening again. In separate investigations, the Army and the Air Force reached similar conclusions. The military has taken steps to address the problems it identified, but no member of the operation faced court-martial. Several weeks after the attack, American officers traveled to the villages to apologize to survivors and the victims' families. They gave each survivor 140,000 Afghanis, or about $2,900 in U.S. terms. Families of the dead received $4,800. This column was written by David S. Cloud and is copyrighted this year in the Los Angeles Times. And now from the Week magazine, let's turn into the health and science section this week with a couple of interesting articles I think you'll enjoy. The first one is entitled "The Lure of Music for Depressed Teenagers." Teenagers who spend a lot of time listening to music are more likely to be depressed, a new study has found, while those who read are considerably less so. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh closely monitored the activity of 106 teenagers, half of whom had been diagnosed with clinical depression over the course of 8 weeks. Surprisingly, they found that the amount of time the subjects spent on TV, movies, video games, and Facebook had no correlation with their mental health, but music did. Those who listened for 5 or more hours per day were 8 times more likely to be depressed than those who didn't listen often. And though only a tiny fraction of the volunteers spent much time reading, avid readers were 90% less likely to be depressed than those who rarely cracked a book or magazine. The study doesn't prove that music causes depression, lead author Brian Primack tells NPR.org, but it does suggest that listening to music appeals to teens who don't have a lot of energy, which is a warning sign of depression. To read, on the other hand, you really have to engage a lot of your brain, something that is harder for depressed teens to muster the energy to do. The next item from Health and Science, Senior Moments Explained. As we get older, the odds increase that we'll blank on where we put the car keys or what we're looking for in the fridge. But such senior moments aren't exactly a memory problem. Rather, they are evidence of a glitch in how brain networks switch between tasks, neuroscientist Adam Ghazali tells LifeScience.com. He and colleagues at the University of California, San Francisco, compared the brains of seniors in their 60s and 70s to those of volunteers in their 20s by having them play 2 memory games. The 2 groups performed almost equally well when asked to look at a picture of a field or a forest, keep it in mind for 15 seconds, and then say whether it matched a second photo. But when researchers interrupted the 2 landscapes with a picture of a face, the seniors proved much less capable of matching the scenes. Scans of their brain show that they were slow to stop processing the face and re-engage in landscape analysis, tasks handled by different parts of the brain. Understanding how the glitch works could allow scientists to devise brain training programs to help older people multitask better, especially now that portable gadgets can distract seniors when they're driving or crossing the street. and another item entitled Order Fosters Tolerance. Could cleaning up clutter make people more open-minded? Researchers from Tilburg University in the Netherlands say it can. Nature.com reports, in a series of innovative experiments, they found that exposure to disorder from standing on a shabby street to looking at a photo of a messy bookshelf made people more likely to agree with negative stereotypes about Muslims and homosexuals and less disposed to donate to charity. They also found that when white subjects were asked to sit down on a trash-strewn train platform, they tended to choose a seat farther away from black people than from white ones. On a clean platform, they didn't discriminate. The authors say their studies suggest that stereotyping may be a way to cope with chaos by mentally organizing people into neat categories, and that investments in tidying up neighborhoods and parks may be relatively inexpensive and effective ways to reduce stereotyping and discrimination. Now, as we move towards the end of our program today, let's take a look at a few items from Talking Points. The first one, Gulf oil spill, lessons learned and ignored. The main question a year after one of the world's worst oil spills is, could it happen again, said Harry Weber in the Associated Press. The answer is, absolutely. Big oil claims safety has improved since the blast on BP's Deepwater Horizon rig killed 11 workers and spewed 207 million gallons of crude oil into the sea, but experts doubt it. While the industry has spent $1 billion on a high-tech containment system that can cap a blown-out well and pump 60,000 barrels of oil a day to surface vessels, that technology hasn't been tested on the seafloor, and a known design flaw still hasn't been fixed in the blowout preventer that should have cut off the deepwater leak. Yet the device is still widely used. Congress is at fault, too, said Francis Beinecke in the HuffingtonPost.com. It has failed to pass a single law to ensure that drilling is safer than it was a year ago. In fact, House Republicans are pushing a trio of new bills to allow deepwater drilling in pristine areas of the Pacific, Atlantic, and Arctic oceans, which will only make our coastal communities more vulnerable to disastrous oil spills. It's as if we learned nothing. Like it or not, expanding deepwater drilling is a matter of necessity, said Stephen Mufson in the Washington Post. The world currently burns through about 88.5 billion barrels of oil a day. That means producers need to discover and develop a field the size of Macondo, the reserve the Deepwater Horizon was tapping, every 13.5 hours. And most of the best prospects are offshore and often in deep waters. The Gulf spill has changed the safety equation, said Sylvia Pfeiffer in the Financial Times. Major oil companies can't afford the bad press and financial damage still being suffered by BP, so they now test vital equipment on rigs more often. Those multinationals also face pressure from junior financial partners who don't want to end up contributing to multi-billion dollar cleanups to adopt the latest safety technologies. And Kobe's foul mouth, a fitting punishment? Kobe Bryant's anti-gay slur and the fallout from it only proves that homophobia is alive and well in the NBA, said William C. Roden in the New York Times. In a fit of anger after being called for a technical foul, the L.A. Lakers star charged the bench, slammed a chair, and spat an obscene insult at referee Bernie Adams, a double F-bomb that was caught on national television. The Human Rights Campaign protested. Bryant issued an obligatory soulless apology, and League Commissioner David Stern fined him $100,000, a mere 0.4% of his $24.8 million annual salary. The fine is meaningless to someone at his pay scale, a symbolic gesture, though Bryant vowed to appeal it anyway. The whole episode, said Daniel Wood in the Christian Science Monitor, reveals one of the insidious elements of pro-sports culture, which has shown a stubborn resistance to the acceptance of homosexuality. And a couple of other small items here as we close the program. Brigham Young University was widely praised last month for invoking its honor code barring fornication and alcohol use against basketball star Brandon Davies, even though his suspension torpedoed the Mormon school's championship hopes. But an analysis shows that nearly 80% of the student-athletes suspended under its provisions since 1993 were representatives of racial minorities, and more than 60% were black men, who are far less likely than BYU's white students to be Mormon. Indoor marijuana cultivation consumes about 1% of the nation's electricity, that according to the U.S. New York Times, and the U.S. Postal Service has admitted that a special stamp commemorating the 125th anniversary of the Statue of Liberty drew its image not from the real thing, but from a 14-year-old replica statue at the New York Casino in Las Vegas. After the stamp collector alerted the U.S. Postal Service to the error, spokesman Roy Betts insisted, "We still love the stamp design and would have selected this photograph anyway." Taxpayers are more disposed than ever to overpay their taxes throughout the year in order to get a heftier annual refund from the IRS. Last year's average refund was $3,003, almost twice the $1,698 of 1999. The IRS expects the trend to continue this year. And we'll conclude with our poll watch. 90% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 24 say they expect to find a career that will bring them happiness, even though only about 25% say life will be easier for them than it was for their parents. And 87% of Americans say the Gulf of Mexico has not completely recovered from the BP spill a year ago. 51% say it will eventually, and 36% say that it never will recover from that tragedy. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I really hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.